This is the Perfectly Mentored Podcast with your host, Jason Portnoy.
Hello, everyone. My guest today is, I'm proud to have known him for a long time, a guy that I've watched grow and achieve success and accomplish a lot of his dreams. One of the nicest and humblest people you'll ever meet. And if you think I'm bullshitting or making this up, just to give you some context, he's probably the only Knicks fan I'd ever let on this show. We see right away he's not perfect. But Ariel Helwani is an award-winning mixed martial arts reporter who works across ESPN platforms. He has several roles at ESPN, including co-host of Ariel and the Bad Guy, a weekly MMA program. He's the host of ongoing live streaming podcast, Ariel Helwani's MMA Show. My Montreal brother, Ariel, welcome.
Yes. Thank you, Jason. It's great to see you. It's been a while. I was trying to remember, when was the last time we actually spoke either in person or virtually or anything like that? I can't even remember. It's been that long. So I appreciate you inviting me on the show, and I hope that you and your family are doing very well.
Likewise. Same to you. And I'll be honest with you, this is a little nerve-wracking for me because I'm just a simple podcast host interviewing an award-winning reporter from ESPN who interviews people for a living. So kind of hard to think you're not going to judge me during all this, but at the end, I want your feedback, and I want to know if I could hang in the big leagues.
Fair enough. I started the exact same way, doing interviews from my computer. In fact, doing it from the same desk that I'm sitting at now, because now, of course, we all work from home, reaching out to people via MySpace at the time. So you got to start somewhere. I love what you're doing. It's great because now, of course, we're at home. Life has changed. So you have to be crafty. You have to think on your toes, and that's what you're doing. So I commend you.
Thank you. I want to start with the obvious here. How do you go from Montreal to Syracuse to choosing to cover a sport that doesn't really have much attention to being the journalist of the year to going to ESPN? Like, detail that journey out for us if you can.
Okay, so it's a crazy story. I'm obviously a proud Montrealer. I grew up in Montreal. If anyone knows Montreal, I grew up in TMR, Town of Mount Royal. And then later we moved to Westmount. And I always loved sports. I always loved American sports. And when I watched sports, obviously I looked up to the players like everyone else, but I really looked up to the broadcasters as well. I loved watching the NBA on NBC and watching Marv Albert and Bob Costas and all those guys and how they started the broadcast, how they spoke during the broadcast, how just the little intricacies of live television. It always fascinated me. And I remember being in the ninth grade at Herzliya High School in Montreal, and we were in English class, Mrs. Blit Hansen's English class, and I was reading Sports Illustrated. We were supposed to be reading some sort of textbook, but I had the textbook here, and then I had the Sports Illustrated inside. And I remember it was an issue of Sports Illustrated where they were ranking the best schools in America for X, Y, and Z. And there was a little blurb in the issue that stated that the best school in America for sports broadcasting was Syracuse University. So I'm in the ninth grade. I say to myself, wow, you can actually go to school and become a sports broadcaster. You can get a degree in this, or you can hone your skills. You can learn how to be a sports writer. This is amazing. So in my mind, I'm going to go to Syracuse eventually. Now, of course, I had a few years to go, but I always kept that dream alive. And eventually, I went to Syracuse in 2001. And as you know, growing up in Montreal and the Jewish community, you don't really leave, certainly not to go to America. It's very expensive. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. You got great universities in Montreal in particular, like McGill, like Concordia. There's a great journalism school in Concordia. So most of my friends, if not all my friends, stayed home. But I really had this dream. I was always a big dreamer and someone who always dreamed of living in America, moving to New York and doing that whole thing. And so I get to Syracuse, and for the first time in my life, I'm actually surrounded by people who had the same dream as I did. I'm surrounded by a bunch of young kids who want to be the next Marv Albert, want to be the next Bob Costas, want to be the next baseball, football, basketball, football. And by the way, Costas and Albert both went to Syracuse as well. So that's why I was really excited to go. They were two of my favorites. And I've always been someone who likes to go down a different path. I don't like to follow the pack, so to speak. And I like to do things a little differently. Grew up in a household where my two older brothers were huge Chicago Bulls fans, and I was a Knicks fan, so I was tortured. Grew up in a household where my two older brothers were Dallas Cowboys fans, and I was a Buffalo Bills fan, so I like to go the other way. And I remember telling my parents in the fall of 2001, you know, there's this sport called mixed martial arts. It's only, at the time, 8 years old, but I feel like it's going to be mainstream at some point. I feel like it's going to explode. And I feel like in about 10 years, there's going to be some executive in some office who's going to say, I know nothing about this sport. I don't understand it, but clearly we have to start paying attention to it. Who's the guy? Get us the guy. who's the face of MMA media? And I said that I want to be that guy. I want to be the Howard Cosell of MMA, much like he was the Howard Cosell of boxing. And so at Syracuse, I started my own radio show, which no one listened to. It was available online. It was at a station called WERW in the student station. It was in a closet. The only two people who would listen consistently were my mother and, at the time, my 10-year-old sister. And the station was so rinky-dink that I couldn't make outgoing calls. So my mom, immigrant from Lebanon, or my 10-year-old sister would have to call the guests, because I would reach out to people via their website, big names. I would just send them emails, would call the guests and pretend to be my producer and then call me on conference. And that's how I would do the interviews back then. So you talk about like starting off humble beginnings. That's pretty much as humble as it gets. So I did the show for 3 years. I was at Syracuse, graduated. It was a great experience. And upon graduating, I actually, because
by the way, you were also there when they won, right?
I was there when they won. Yeah, I was there when Carmelo Anthony won and the Syracuse Orange. And I used to see him walking around campus. That was really cool as well. And my junior year, you know, they encouraged us to get internships going into your senior year and all that stuff. So I got an internship working at HBO Sports. And it was a great experience working there, living in New York. I stayed at the 92nd Street Y for an entire summer, communal showers. It wasn't exactly a fine living, but it was a great experience. My brothers lived in New York at the time, so that was good too. And then when I graduated, I got a job working for NBC at the 2004 NBC Olympics in Athens, Greece. I was going to be a runner. A runner is someone that just helps out wherever help is needed for the broadcast. It could be, you know, photocopying. It could be printing things. It could be getting coffee. You're just kind of there, like a utility player. Unfortunately, 2 months before the Olympics, I broke my ankle playing basketball. And so I had to pull out because obviously I can't be a runner if I'm on crutches. At the same time, almost like 2 days later, I get a job offer from HBO, asked me to come back and work on a documentary because at the time, HBO Sports was sort of the gold standard of sports documentaries. And they asked me if I wanted to work on a specific documentary for the next year. It was about the 1985 NCAA championship basketball game between the Georgetown Hoyas and the Villanova Wildcats. And the star of the Georgetown Hoyas at the time was a man named Patrick Ewing. And as you know, I adored Patrick Ewing growing up. And I took this as an opportunity to perhaps work on a show about Patrick Ewing, even though he lost that game, but maybe meet him. It was just a very exciting project. So I took the job, moved to New York, and it was a great experience. Unfortunately, a year after the contract with HBO ended and the documentary aired, they didn't rehire me because I had a 1-year visa to work in the States. When you're a Canadian who goes to school in the States, you get a 1-year visa to work in the field that you studied in. So they got the 1-year visa to work at HBO, but then once it expired, they didn't want to hire someone who is at the entry level that I was at. They could just hire an American and not go through all the paperwork. So I was essentially on the streets. I didn't have a job. I was unemployed. Luckily, several months later, I got another job. I worked in TV production for several years, but in 2007, and I'm sorry for this long story, but this is the answer to the question. In 2007, I get a job working for Spike TV, which now is known as Paramount Network, but it was like the guys network, and they were the home of the UFC at the time. And at that point, I decided, all right, I'm going down this production route, so I'm going to stick with this. And Spike TV was the home of the UFC, and I loved MMA. I still kept tabs on it, and I wanted to work for the network that was airing it. I got the job in September of 2007, and I realized very quickly that they didn't actually do any of the, they didn't make the program. They didn't produce any of it. There was nothing creative about the job. And that was very disheartening for me. So a week after starting my job with Spike, I quit. And I went to the president of Spike TV Sports office. And I'll never forget, his name is Brian Diamond. And I told him that, you know, I just don't think that this opportunity is good for me. I'm someone who kind of follows his heart. I'm very passionate about things. And if it didn't feel right, it just didn't feel right. And he told me this was the biggest mistake of my life. I would regret this forever. How could you do this? It's unprofessional, all that stuff and more. But I was pretty certain this wasn't the right spot for me. And they made me stick around for a month and a half until they found someone to replace me. I was sort of the black sheep there. And when I was at my cubicle every day thinking about my next step, I viewed this as the crossroads of my life. And I started my own website. And I told myself, I'm going to start this website in October of 2007. I'm going to give myself 6 months from October of 2007 to April 1st of 2008. And my mission is to show people that I can be a great interviewer and that I will focus on MMA because I felt like there was a great void in terms of good journalists and broadcasters in MMA. And so every day at 8 a.m., I was going to post an interview with a fighter. How was I going to reach out to these fighters? I was going to reach out to them via their personal websites or MySpace, which was the main social media site at the time. Every morning at 8 a.m., I would post it. I would send out like 30 emails a day. I would get people who trickle in. And over time, you know, once I started rolling, I would start to get big names who would write back to me. Chuck Liddell, George St. Pierre, Tito Ortiz. Like, this was really exciting. Unfortunately, with days remaining on my self-imposed deadline, no one was reaching out. There just wasn't a lot of opportunities. Thankfully, with 3 days left on March 28th, which just so happened to be my future wife's birthday, I got an offer from the Wasserman Media Group, which is a big firm in America that was starting their own MMA website. And they asked me if I wanted to head it up. And I told them, yes, I would like to, but these are my goals and this is my vision. They asked me, how much do you want to get paid? And I was like, all right, well, I made X amount at Spike. Why don't I just double it to see if I could prove that guy that he was wrong, that in fact, I was making the right choice. They said yes to that. And that's when my MMA career started. So I started working for them. Then I went to Versus, which was a TV network in America in 2009. I worked for AOL Fanhouse. AOL Fanhouse, my site at AOL, was bought by SB Nation, Vox Media. I stayed with Vox for 9 years. I also worked for Fox Sports for 5 years. And then in 2018, I went to ESPN. So that's kind of the short, long story.
Wow. We're going to go back and forth on sure. this. I want to step back for a second and talk about when you got to Syracuse. We have a lot of entrepreneurs who listen to this show, let alone UFC fans and your fans. But when you got to Syracuse, it's your first time, like you said, you know, when you're planning your map to Syracuse, you're alone, right? In your bubble of friends, no one else wants to be a sports journalist. It's you. You want to go there. Then you get to Syracuse and you're surrounded by thousands of people within a classroom or within a program that want to do exactly what you want to do. You share the exact same dream. So it's seeing your competition. And I feel when people start a business, they get very passionate and then they look what's out there and they see their entire competition. So what went through your mind and what advice do you have for people who then start seeing the saturation or the marketplace or the competition and then get scared?
Yeah, I would say the most important thing and the key to success, at least in my opinion, is to be different, to be unique, to look at what everyone else is doing. And perhaps you can take elements here or there, but you have to A, stay true to yourself, and you have to be different, because if you're not different and you're coming into a market where there's a lot of people doing similar things, it's going to be very hard to break through. So a lot of young journalists write me emails constantly and say, how do I make it? How do I get to where you are, et cetera? And I tell them the most important thing is to be different. Look at what everyone is doing right now in 2020 and try to do the complete opposite, or at least try to do something that isn't happening right now or you feel like can be done infinitely better than what is currently going on right now. And so I think it's very important to be different. I think it's very important to be unique. And when you're being different and unique, you also have to stay true to yourself, because you can't fake it. Like, after a while, your true colors will be exposed. And if you can present to people a different kind of product or a different kind of, you know, persona or anything like that, I think people will come to you. But also important to remember, it takes time. You know, I graduated in 2004. I made it to ESPN in 2018, 14 years. I think a lot of people get very anxious, like, oh, I got this great idea and it's gonna, you know, catch fire in a year, 6 months. No, that will never happen unless you get supremely lucky. It's going to take time. It might even take a decade. It might take 2 decades. But if you're passionate, if you believe in yourself, then you can succeed.
I love it. And if you look at it from a business standpoint, I mean, most businesses fail, right? They say 90% of businesses fail. Why are you copying what the 90% are doing, right? You got to be different. And your class, if how many people got to the level you're at, probably like 1%. So why would you follow exactly the same path what everyone else is going to be doing?
Right.
So I think you have to be different. You left your job after 1 week, you just said. How much of that at your age at that time was complete self-awareness of knowing yourself versus an emotional decision?
Probably a bit of both. I mean, I was lucky at the time that I didn't have any kids. I wasn't married. I didn't have that many responsibilities. I was able to pay the rent. And that's why I gave myself 6 months. Like, I wasn't going to just do that. I felt like I needed a deadline. I felt like I needed that pressure to try to prove people wrong and try to break through. And so that's why it was very important for me, April 1st, 2008, this is going to end. If this doesn't work out, I'm not just going to, like, you know, wander in the wind. I'm going to go back to TV production. And so that gave me a little bit of an edge. It gave me some, you know, some motivation to get going right off the bat. And I really just looked at the landscape. And as someone who studied, you know, sports journalism and looked at other sports, the way they were covered, and then I compared it to MMA, I was like, there's no one really doing this the way I think it should be done. Little things, showing up to events, wearing a suit, having a microphone and a mic flag, just trying to make it a little more like the other mainstream sports, things that are taken for granted now, even in MMA. But back then, no one was doing it. No one was showing up to events a lot of the guys would like have camcorders and interview the fighters like this. Like they would hold the camcorder and then ask questions. I was like, no, that's not professional. Hire a cameraman, show up to the event, have a camera, have a mic flag, have a microphone, dress up. And so what I did early on was once I started getting rolling with this website, MMA Rated, I used to go to like, okay, let's say there was an event happening in South Florida. I would go on Craigslist and I would, you know, tell people I need a cameraman. And I would pay you X amount. Sometimes I got lemons. Sometimes I got horrible Karen who didn't know what the heck they were doing, but that's how I had to do it. I had to try to make contacts in all these different places in order to have someone, because I felt like it was really important that they held the camera. And by the way, the website that I started from my cubicle in Spike TV and that I gave myself 6 months to get noticed, I couldn't think of a good name. And one day I was just on one of those websites where, you know, you type in a name and you see if the URL is available. And I somehow thought of Jarry Park, which you may know of in Montreal, the former home of the Montreal Expos. Now it's like a municipal park. I believe they have tennis events there. JarryPark.com, for some reason, was available. I couldn't believe that the city of Montreal didn't own it. And so I bought JarryPark.com and I rechristened it the Coliseum of Combat Sports. And I wrote this whole thing about how I was once a baseball fan and the Expos broke my heart. And so now I was going to revive Jarry Park into this Coliseum of Combat Sports. And so that was my sort of ode to where I came from in Montreal.
Was dressing up when everyone else was, probably when you started wearing Affliction t-shirts or Tap Out t-shirts. And I know this because when I was in the clothing business, you and I spoke about all that. So I know exactly the time frame. Was dressing up you being different or you trying to be professional?
Both. I do think that when you go, so it's funny you mentioned like Affliction and Tap Out, you would go to events back in the day and you would look at Media Row and media members are wearing Affliction Tap Out. They're wearing t-shirts of fighters like that. First of all, I don't think that that's professional. I don't think it's ethical. Like you can't be rooting for people. You can't be
like Mark Albert didn't show up in like a Knicks jersey, right?
Yeah, of course. Like, and even though maybe deep down he was a Knicks fan because he grew up in New York, like you can't cover a Chuck Liddell fight wearing a Chuck Liddell t-shirt. I mean, that's just crazy. So it was important for me to like, one of the courses in Syracuse that really stuck with me over the years was journalism ethics. And it was one of the first classes I took. And these are things like you don't really learn about. Certainly I didn't learn about journalism ethics in Marianopolis or in Herzliya. So you start to open your eyes like, wow, there's actually rules here and there's a professional way of doing things. And this is how you're respected as a journalist, as a media member. And so I took those values when I started my MMA career. So dressing up was important because I wanted to give off the impression that I was serious, that I was professional, that I was unbiased, that I was going to do things the right way. But also it was to be different because I looked at everyone else and I was like, well, these guys are wearing t-shirts. I think if I show up wearing a suit on fight night, it will show to people that I'm taking this seriously, that I'm wanting to cover MMA in the most professional manner possible. So that's why I say it's a bit of both.
Got it. Listening to your story, it just sounds like you didn't have the easiest path to getting to where you're at. You had a lot of different setbacks. There are a lot of the rugs pulled out under your carpet sometimes. You know, you tasted the champagne, thought you were going to be happy there, and then things get pulled away a little bit. How'd your mindset not change? Like the people listening here right now battle one failure, and sometimes business owners just quit after one thing. How'd you stay positive and stay after it?
So it's funny you talk about the rug being pulled, and I'm not trying to make myself into some sort of like victim here or have anyone cry for me, but the story I just told you pales in comparison to what I experienced later on and throughout the career once it got rolling. There have been many setbacks. That first website that I got the opportunity with, after 6 months, they sold their parent company to another internet company, and they had all these websites. They had like all these sort of X Games type websites like surfing and skateboarding and snowboarding. They kept all those except for ours, which was doing great because they didn't want to be in the MMA business. So after 6 months and building up this new website, I was out of a job. And then, you know, when I went to AOL Fanhouse, they sold it. They sold it off to the Huffington Post. And then I was worried about being out of a job there. And then a new company bought. So there were a lot of things there. But things get really difficult for me when I start to work for Fox Sports. So Fox then becomes the broadcast partner of the UFC in 2011. 10 years after I told my parents that in 10 years, this sport is going to be mainstream and there's going to be people looking for the voices of the sport to employ. And I had a meeting with them and they sat down with me and talked to me about, you know, what I had done in my career, my vision, and I ended up getting hired starting in 2012 to work for Fox Sports. And initially that was a great experience. I'm on television now, finally. I get to realize my dream of being a broadcaster, doing things on TV, not just on the internet. Slowly but surely, it became a really tough job because of their relationship with the UFC. And there were a lot of issues in terms of the fact that I was working for Fox broadcast partner, but I also had my regular job working for this website, MMAfighting.com, which was 100% independent and owned by Vox Media. And sometimes they would get mad about some of the things I would talk about or report on for Vox while I'm still working for Fox, FOX. And to make a very long story short, in 2016, the UFC asked Fox to fire me because not because I did anything wrong, not because I reported anything inaccurate, not because I was a bad employee. They just didn't like what I was talking about on my other site at the MMA fighting job. And that was heartbreaking because there's only one TV partner for the UFC. And if you want to be on TV, you have to work for them at the time. And so I was very unceremoniously relieved of my duties, a 2.5 minute phone call, heartbreaking. And again, you know, that's a tough time. And there were other things that happened. I was banned and all this stuff. I mean, all kinds of drama. But the main thing, to answer your question, I feel very strongly about this. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Don't lick your wounds. Don't feel bad. Don't feel like anyone owes you anything. Don't feel like anyone is going to feel sorry for you. You get knocked down, you can feel bad for a day. Dust yourself off and prove them wrong. Prove everyone that they made a mistake. Prove everyone that you're the man, that you could go out there and be successful, and they're going to rue the day that they ever wronged you. And that has always been my mindset, because there's been a lot of stumbling blocks. There's been a lot of issues over the years, but I just refuse to feel bad for myself. In fact, what happens is I get so fired up and emotional that I just, like, you know, I rev it up even more to try to prove everyone wrong. Later on, I'm working for Showtime, part of their coverage of Mayweather McGregor. I get told 2 hours before that I'm off the broadcast because the UFC didn't want me to be a part of it. I'm in LA wearing my suit. I just flew overnight on a red eye, and I'm being told, not because you're bad at your job, but it's because they have a personal grudge against you. What did I do? I said to myself, I'm going to cover this fight, this mega fight, better than any other outlet on the planet. And I would go toe to toe with anyone today and back up that fact that we covered that event better than anyone on the planet, because I wanted to prove everyone that they made a mistake for wronging me. So that's always been my mindset, and that's what I would tell other people to do. Don't feel bad for yourself. Don't lick your wounds. Go out there and prove them wrong.
So that, when does that chip on your shoulder become dangerous and you start making emotional decisions versus like the right move? Like, I get it fuels you, but sometimes, you know, if it's not harnessed properly, that chip on your shoulder could do a lot of damage for you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that I've been perfect and that I haven't made mistakes along the way, but for the most part, I feel like the chip on my shoulder has benefited me, has been a good thing for me, because, again, like I said, it gives me an edge. It gives me some motivation. I want to prove people wrong. And I still feel like, someone was telling me recently, like, man, you know, during this lockdown, quarantine, whatever you want to call it, you've been like pumping out a lot of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I'm pissed off. And like, what are you pissed off about? I'm like, I feel like people are doubting me. I feel like people don't think that I can do it right now. I don't have a fancy studio. I'm working for ESPN. Where's my studio? I'm sitting in my spare bedroom here. I started this way. I started at the same table. I started reaching out to fighters and doing things, audio interviews before podcasts were a thing, via MySpace. This is what I'm used to. I'm not used to the fancy studio. I'm not used to like the big corporate job. I'm used to doing things on my own and, you know, the kind of rugged way. So luckily, so far, the chip on my shoulder and that attitude hasn't affected me negatively all that much. I would say that it has benefited me a lot more than it has, you know, hurt me.
So you got to ESPN, right? That was the dream. That was the big, the big leagues for you. You made it there. Has the feeling wore off a little bit that you're at ESPN?
So I will admit that when I got to ESPN, like, obviously, like you said, you know, growing up in Montreal, where else? Like, if you have this dream, where else, like, are you going to dream of, right? Like, you're going to dream of ESPN. I didn't dream of TSN. I didn't dream of RDS. I didn't dream of any of that. Like, I wanted to work for the worldwide leader in sports. I wanted to work for ESPN. And that was 100% the dream. And you get there and you're like, holy smokes, you're here. You're playing for the Yankees now, right? Like, this is a big deal. And I will admit, early on, it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. And it was a lot different, you know, because when I was working for Vox Media, kind of run like a startup. And of course, ESPN owned by Disney, it's a lot different. And so maybe I wanted everything to just kind of be the same, or I wanted everyone to have the same mentality that I had back at Vox. It was kind of run like a mom and pop shop. And that wasn't the case, obviously, because ESPN is a behemoth. And so maybe I was a little impatient early on or something like that. And I would get, you know, emotional. I'm an emotional guy. I get emotional. But now, 2 years in, I mean, it's been incredible. I, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to go to ESPN was I wanted to prove to people also that I wasn't just an MMA guy. Like if I wanted to just be an MMA guy, I would stay at my previous job because they treated me really well and they paid me pretty well. And it was a good life. But I really wanted to prove to people that I was much more than just an MMA guy. And in particular, that I could be a basketball guy as well, because that was always my first love. You know, back when I was younger, there was no such thing as MMA in the UFC. I loved basketball first, more so than hockey or anything like that. And so, of course, ESPN, ABC, the home of the NBA. And my goal was to try to somehow break through into that. 3 months into my time at ESPN in September of 2018, I found out who, you know, the head of the NBA and ESPN department was. I sent him an email and I said, I'd just love to meet with you for a few minutes and introduce myself. He was kind enough to reply and we set up a meeting. And I got a good feeling from him very early on in the meeting, almost immediately, just kind of like a straight shooter, real kind of guy, which isn't always the case with executives. And I said, look, I don't want to waste a lot of your time. I just want to let you know that I'm a massive NBA fan. I love the NBA. I would love to be a part of your team in any way, shape, or form, any capacity. If you ever need someone, you know, if you're ever stuck and you need someone at the last minute, please consider me. He said, you know, I got to be honest, no one's ever really come in and said this, and I don't know a lot about you. I appreciate it. I'll look into it. And, you know, also, we don't really have anything right now, but hey, you never know what's going to happen. I said, that's all I can ask for. Thank you. So that was September, maybe 7 or so months later, they reach out to me and say, hey, would you like to work on the Summer League broadcasts this summer, last summer, 2019 in Las Vegas? I was like, whoa, I get to work on the Summer League broadcast. It's amazing. As a sideline reporter, this is incredible. This is the dream. And I also was going to be in Las Vegas during that time because the UFC was having an event there. And so they gave me 3 games to do working as a sideline reporter. Vince Carter was the analyst. I'm like in meetings with Vince Carter. This is surreal. This is unbelievable. And afterwards, you know, I thought it went pretty well. Thought I did a pretty good job. Didn't really hear much afterwards. And then in October, I get an email from someone who works on the NBA at ESPN. And they wrote, hey, Ariel, hope you're doing well. Here are your first 2 games for the 2019-2020 season. I was like, wow, I didn't even know that like you guys were going to bring me back. I didn't know that you were going to give me a shot on the regular season broadcast. The first game is Dallas at New Orleans, which would have been Zion Williamson's home opener. Unfortunately, he got injured. But that was very exciting initially when I found out about it. And then I looked at who the broadcasters were. It was Mike Breen, who's the voice of the NBA right now, and also a Knicks broadcaster who I love, and Jeff Van Gundy, who's my favorite Knicks coach of all time. So it says Breen, Van Gundy, and Helwani. Do you know how surreal that is? That's like winning the lottery, like winning some sort of like fantasy camp sweepstakes where you get to hang out with these guys. Game 2 is Christmas Day, Celtics at Raptors, first ever Christmas game in Canada. And like it was amazing. In the end, I got to do 5 games this season. That was incredible. So like when you asked me about my time at ESPN, it's been amazing covering MMA. The UFC is now over there. So coincidentally, they became, you know, the broadcast partner for the UFC, but also doing the NBA stuff and being accepted by that community as well has been, you know, a dream come true.
UFC being now with ESPN, is there like flash of deja vu when that happened with Fox for you?
Yeah, especially at the beginning, I was really worried. And there have been moments here or there, but for the most part, ESPN has really had my back. Like everything that Fox didn't do, ESPN has done. When times got a little funky, they continuously have my back. They continuously support me. They feel, you know, like I feel like we're teammates, you know what I mean? As opposed to like, oh, just my employer who's going to scold me if the other side complains about me. So I cannot complain about the way they've treated me and the way they've had my back. And that's why I have their back as well. I'm very proud. Like some people say like, oh, you're such a ESPN shill. Yeah, guess what? I'm happy to be an ESPN shill. I'm happy to be on their team. Yes. Hey, if they support me, I'll support them. Fox didn't support me. It ended poorly. You know, who knows what happens down the line. You know, I don't want to necessarily hold a grudge. This life is too short and the world is too small. But right now, ESPN has treated me incredibly well and they have always had my back and they have made it a point to tell me that they have my back and that they support me. And that really means a lot.
Talking about holding a grudge and persevering through hard times, I don't want to go too deep into this because I don't think this defines you. I think, you know, this was just one issue that put you in the limelight, the UFC ban that you got. When you first had the UFC ban, now you're obviously back. How do you then stay positive wanting to cover that sport that treated you like that and that you have to go in and now you're back and you have to kind of swallow your pride and still do a bunch of stuff? Like, how do you, you know, so many people have trouble swallowing their pride. Like, what goes on through your mind of how you go back into work the next day after that happens.
So that was incredibly emotional because, you know, they made it personal. It's one thing to not like me. It's one thing to not be a fan of my work or to not want to talk to me, things like that. But like when you're kicking me out and essentially hurting my livelihood, right? Like if I'm banned now, maybe people don't want to work for me anymore. And you already hurt my livelihood when you got me fired from Fox. And so I lost a paycheck there. At the time, I'm a father of two. We have a third on the way. Like, this seems a little too personal, right? And I'll never forget when I was banned from the UFC and I was kicked out of the building, the Forum in Inglewood. It was UFC 199. You know what's so crazy, man? You know what's so freaking crazy? Today's the 4-year anniversary of that day. Wow. How about that? Today's the 4-year anniversary of that day, June 4th, 2016. I'll never forget Dana White saying to me that my partner, Lorenzo, his partner, Lorenzo Fertitta, who's this big casino mogul in Vegas, he said, Lorenzo, just put a bullet in your head. Your career is over. And I was like, wow. Like, I remember thinking, like, to hear that from someone who's from Vegas, like, they just put a bullet in my head. That's a crazy analogy.
And from someone you had a really good relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
In the beginning of your career, like, you had access to Dana White that probably no one else had.
Yeah, he was always available. We had a great relationship. And I think that the one who had the issue with me was Lorenzo. He didn't really like that I would talk about the business and stuff like that. And so he kind of pushed for this. And so once they banned me, after I broke a series of news stories, and nothing big, like this guy signing or this fight is happening, like just
typical regular stuff.
Yeah, like what Woj or Schefter does, Jeff Passan, whatever. Like nothing that would hurt their business in any way, shape, or form. And obviously that has been proven. So they banned me and it was very emotional because it's like, okay, am I going to get fired now? Am I going to lose my job? I can't cover the UFC. Like now I'm the banned guy and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to deal with it. So I'll never forget tweeting, standing in the parking lot. And I've still never even watched the last two fights at UFC 199. And they're two very memorable fights, including the main event where Michael Bisping knocks out Luke Rockhold and everyone's celebrating that moment today in the on the 4-year anniversary. I sent out a series of tweets saying like, hey, I've been banned. I'm not going to be able to do my post-fight stuff. I'm sorry. I appreciate it. Hopefully, you know, cooler heads prevail is basically what I said. And I went to my hotel room. I was a little bit nervous that something worse would happen. So I remember packing my stuff and going to the airport like 6 hours early. And this is like 1 a.m. at this point. So I just went to the airport 6 hours early. I had like a 6 a.m. or so flight just because I wanted to be around other people and I didn't want to be in a hotel room by myself. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I was a little spooked that this had come to this. And I was on the plane and I got the Wi-Fi and I remember turning on my phone and going on Twitter and seeing that my tweets had exploded, that everyone was talking about it, like Rich Eisen and Dan Patrick and Dan Le Batard. These people were reaching out to me to do interviews. I was like, holy crap, because what the UFC wanted was for it to stay in the bubble and that no one would find out about it. But it, for whatever reason, broke through and everyone was like, the Gazette wrote about it. CNN wrote about it. The Washington Post, every outlet on the CBC, everyone was writing about this banned journalist. So I was like, all right, I do a show every Monday. On this show, I'm going to talk about everything. I'm going to kind of tell my side of the story. But before the show, I kind of went on this media tour and I didn't start the media tour. Everyone reached out to me, Le Batard, Eisen, Dan Patrick, etc. All the big shows in America. I was on the team in Montreal with Tony Marinaro. That was cool too. And I said, all right, I'll do these interviews. I'll tell my story and then I'll go on the air and tell my story further there. So I did the interviews and that helped get the word out. But then I go on my podcast, which usually is filled with a ton of guests. And I just did like a 2 to 2.5 hour show where I just told the whole story of my relationship with the UFC and my time with Fox and the ups and downs, the mistakes and all that stuff. I just told everything. And I got emotional on the air and I cried on the air and people still make fun of me to this day. And I don't take anything back. I don't regret anything. And while this was happening, there was like this movement that started, hashtag free Helwani, people posting, you know, screen grabs of them canceling their subscription to UFC Fight Pass, which is like their Netflix. And it just, the whole thing exploded. While I was on the air, Dana White went on TMZ and doubled down and said the only way that I would ever be allowed back to a UFC event was if I bought a ticket. So he was not relenting. And so I did the broadcast. It was emotional. People are all talking about it. It was surreal. Like, it's just like you're being talked about on the news. SportsCenter reaches out to me to be on with Scott Van Pelt. I never been on ESPN before. I didn't work for ESPN.
All while you're still battling the emotions of your livelihood being stripped.
Yes.
Away right now.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'll never forget walking home that day, that afternoon. At this point, it's like 6 p.m. on a beautiful June day. And I was like, all right, you know, I actually feel really good now. I feel like I got it off my shoulders. I got it off my chest. I feel better. I told the world the truth. And now we'll see what happens. And I felt like this sense of relief that this is my new reality and that I will tackle this. I'm not going to feel sorry for myself. Like I said, I'm going to tackle this as best as I can. And I was motivated. And so that night, like I said, SportsCenter reaches out to me. I tell my story, and it was surreal that the first time I'm ever on ESPN or SportsCenter, it's talking about myself. Like, that goes against every rule in journalism to talk, make yourself the story, talk about yourself. I do the interview with them for the 11 o'clock SportsCenter, I believe it was, at 7:30. An hour or so after doing the interview, I get a call from the CEO of Vox Media, who I worked for, saying that the UFC had reached out to them and that they wanted to fix it and that they were going to send out a press release after they sent it to us to see if we're okay with it, at peace with it, saying that my credentials and my two colleagues' credentials who were with me, who had nothing to do with it, but they were just kind of innocent bystanders in all this, that we were going to be like reinstated. They sent us the press release, and I think 5 minutes later, they made it public. So we never even had a chance to look it over. They took a shot at me in the press release, but that was fine. And 2 hours later, you know, 2 hours later, I was back. And the press release comes out like at 10 p.m. on Monday night now, 24 hours after all, or 48 hours after all this happens. SportsCenter finds out about it. They're like, wait, you're back? So then I had to go on again on SportsCenter to talk about now being the guy who got banned and was reinstated. That was surreal. Now I'm on twice. And so I didn't really have a lot of time to feel bad. Now, of course, early on when I like was back, it was very weird. It was very uncomfortable being at the events. Like, no one wanted to talk to me. It was like I had some sort of disease. None of the UFC employees wanted to talk to me. And the fans were all cheering for me and everything. And they like turned me into some sort of martyr for journalism, which I wasn't. I was just, you know, a guy doing my job, and this happened. And all of a sudden, you know, I think it endeared the fans to me, and they had my back. And so that's why I will always say that, yeah, I work for ESPN now, but I also work for the fans, because if they didn't have my back, I would not have been back, right? I would not have returned. And so they really helped me out, and I'll never forget that.
But how do you let it go? How do you show up back to work and just forget that? For like, yeah, it was a personal shot, right? So it wasn't like, hey, he's a bad journalist, let's get rid of him. It was, in your mind, personal. How do you then go back and not take things personally?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I do take things personally a lot, and I get emotional. I go back to Syracuse and I say, like, it's important to be unbiased. I'm very proud of the fact that no one calls me like a UFC hater. Yeah, sure, I'll criticize them, and I'm not afraid to, but I'll also give them a lot of props when they do great things and put on great fights and put on great events. So I didn't want to be painted as like the disgruntled guy. I didn't want to be viewed as the biased guy. And I've just been able to very easily like compartmentalize my feelings towards them and what they did to me. And a lot of the people who were around then aren't around anymore. Of course, Dana White is still around. But it's like people ask me, well, what's your relationship with him now? And it's non-existent. It's not like he sends me like threatening texts or is rude to me. Like, we just don't talk. We haven't talked since that day, exactly 4 years ago. So it's easy to just like view him as a guy who I cover. And that's it. There's no other. It gets tricky when there's another relationship there, a private relationship, right? But it's all like just surface stuff. And as long as I can continue to do my job, as long as it doesn't continue to make it personal and doesn't try to get me fired or anything like that, like, I'm okay with it. You don't have to like me. You don't have to want to talk to me. To your point earlier, if he never talks to me ever again, I probably will have talked to him more than anyone else in the sport, because he was so accessible towards me, you know, early on in my career. So it hasn't been all that tough. Yeah. Are there moments where, you know, like I was like, man, would life be different if I had this income or that job, or if he went into this, like, why do you have to get me fired? Like, why couldn't he have just like yelled at me? Like most, you know, executives, but you move on. And I think everything has worked out for the best.
So wrapping up, for people who want to put themselves on camera and they want to be out there more, but they don't love how they look on camera. They think they too much. What advice do you have? Is this something you worked on? Did you start off that way too, and you've consciously worked on it? Like, what advice do you have?
Well, I still think I'm not good. Just said right now. I don't think that I'm polished at all. And
I think you're pretty polished.
I appreciate it. I'm my harshest critic. I really am. You know,
do you watch your shows back? Do you ever?
Sometimes, but it's hard, man. It really is. It really is hard, because I almost hate it every time. Or, why did you say that? Why did you talk like that? Why didn't you ask that question? How could you forget this? I get so mad. I mean, there are times where I'm so mad that I'm yelling at myself at the top of my lungs. Like, I'm like hitting myself in the head. I'm just a crazy person. It's like, oh, you blew it. You suck. That's how I talk to myself. Probably not the smartest thing, but that's just the way I am. Yeah. And so what I would say is, just like someone who wants to be an NFL quarterback or point guard in the NBA, it's all about reps, right? The more you do something, the better you get at it. And it's not just about sports, it's about anything. Like, the more you do something, the more you read, the more you write, the more you talk to other people, the more you practice being an interviewer, the more you ask questions, the more you study other people, you will inherently become better at your job. I'm talking media, this can apply to anyone else. And so to me, it's always been about reps. Don't just do one interview a month. Don't just write one article a month. Like, no, try to do 2, 3, 4, 5 a day. Try to do 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 a week, that type of thing. So you'll start to develop, you know, patterns, you'll start to develop confidence, you'll study other people and try to implement their styles into your style and make your own style. And it's, so it's just all about reps, whether it's actually doing the interviews or studying other interviews, listening to other interviews, reading articles, or whatever you want to do in media. The more you do it, the better you'll be. You know, the whole 10,000 hour thing. I mean, I believe in all of that, and I still don't feel like I've mastered it. And I still feel like I've got a lot of work to do before I could ever be considered, you know, in even like 1/10 as good as someone like Howard Cosell, or even in the same like freaking breath as someone like him. So still got a lot of work to do. It takes a while. You know, for me, I still feel this way, and I've been doing it, what, you know, I guess professionally now 14 or so years. But I would just say to anyone, like, do it as much as possible, because the more you do it, the better you'll get.
You still get nervous at all?
Yeah, I get nervous. I remember like the first time I was on camera for Fox, my heart was beating so much that it felt like it was going to come out of my throat. Like, that's how nervous I was. Like, I was getting lightheaded. And my first appearance on Christmas Day, NBA on ESPN on Christmas Day, it was me. They didn't tell me beforehand that I was going to go this way, but like 2 minutes before, the producer tells me in my ear, is like, okay, you're going to take us out of a break, stand under the basket. The game is already in progress. Stand under the basket, take us out of the break. No, bring us out of the break, meaning like commercial ends, I'm on camera, and you're going to do a 1 minute report on the state of basketball in Canada. So it's like, welcome back to Scotiabank Arena in Toronto, where the Raptors lead 25-22 over the Celtics. I'm Ariel Helwani. You know, basketball has really come a long way in this country. It's just this lens looking at you with 20,000 people in the arena. God knows how many people watching. Yeah, it feels like my heart is coming out of my chest. But in terms of like the interviews and all that stuff, I've definitely gone a lot.
And you're like, this is my moment, right? Like, if I blow this,
oh my God, if I stumble
back, yeah.
Yeah. And I will admit, I didn't like the way I performed on that broadcast. The walk-off interview with Jaylen Brown of the Celtics, I thought I did a horrible job. And I went back to my room and I yelled at myself that night. And so I'd love a do-over if I can. But I still get nervous. I still get anxious. I'm kind of an anxious person to begin with. Like, my palms are always sweaty. And, you know, I think a lot of Jewish people can relate with me. We're just sort of anxious people. And maybe that gives me my edge, right? Maybe that doesn't let me rest on my laurels and, you know, making me want to be better and prove people wrong and things like that. Because I feel like if I would have lost that over time, I wouldn't be where I am today, where I keep having to prove to others and myself that I belong.
So what's next for you, right? You wanted ESPN. That was the big leagues for you. Check. Done. What's next?
Well, I'd love to be more established in the world of basketball. I don't want to ever leave MMA. I never, ever, ever want to leave MMA. I'm still very passionate about it, and I still feel like I have a lot to do in the sport and to cover the sport. But man, tasting that NBA apple was great. And I know I'm the lowest on the totem pole. Like, there are amazing broadcasters who work on the NBA on ESPN. And the best part about them has been how welcoming they have been towards me, texting me saying, hey, if you need anything, if you need to meet this person, if you need any tips, advice, like, that's just incredible. They could have been like, who's this MMA guy? Like, what are you doing here? You know what I mean? And they've been anything but that. So if I can continue that path and get a game or two here and continue to do my thing with the NBA, I feel very passionate about the NBA, not as much as other sports. Can certainly talk about other sports and follow them extensively. But like, the NBA is something in my heart that I really love, much like MMA. I'm very passionate about interviewing people. That's my favorite thing to do, whether it's, you know, podcast, TV show, radio. I've been getting to do more radio. I love radio as a medium. You know, I remember growing up, I would sit in my bed at night, and at night we would get WFAN in New York, because, you know, once night falls and there's less activity in the sky, you can hear it better. You couldn't get it during the day, so it would be 6:60 a.m. And I would listen to the Knicks post game show on WFAN. And it was just like something magical about listening to New York sports radio all the way in Montreal in my bed under the covers. So I love radio, and I love talking about sports. And who knows, one day maybe I evolve and branch out a little bit. I still have a lot of big dreams, and I still want to prove to people that, you know, I can be the Howard Cosell of whatever. I could be the man. And I feel like being at ESPN is allowing me to slowly but surely start to do that.
Love it. I can't wait to see you cover your first Knicks game and see if you could really remain.
Well, these days it's easy. These days it's super easy. It's not hard at all. Back then, 90s with Patrick and Charles Oakley and those guys, different, but these days super easy. You still feel strongly about those guys?
Yeah, I do.
They have a great team.
I'm a loyal person, right? Mm-hmm. So most of my teams have been misery, right? So like rooting for Cowboys, Pacers.
Wait, you got two Super Bowls.
Yes, but I'm talking about in the last like 10 years.
Listen, I'll take one Super Bowl. Just give me one.
Sure, you got three chances.
Yeah, four, actually.
Four, yeah. There you go. Four chances. Sorry, my bad. Yeah. All right, moment of truth. Can I hang in the big leagues?
Oh, absolutely. Great questions, man. Honestly, you asked a couple there. I was like, oh, that was good. That was a good follow-up about, you know, how do you not make it personal, right? Very good. I like your demeanor. You know what's a very important thing about being an interviewer? I always view interviewing like being in a fight. And when you're in a fight, especially in a boxing match, right, you have to be quick. Jab and get out of the way. Double jab, get out of the way. Move your head, duck, bob, weave. And that to me is like, throw it out there and get out of the way. I also kind of always viewed it as like being a point guard. And something like Walt Frazier, I heard him say one time, you know, you pass and you get out of the way, right? And so to me, long-winded questions where you're trying to prove that you know more than the other person, or you're just trying to prove that like you did your research, unnecessary. Perfect question, 5 to 10 words, why, how come, how did you feel? Things like that, boom, and then you get out of the way. Never interrupt, which you didn't. Let you know, even sometimes at the beginning, like yesterday I interviewed a guy named Tyron Woodley, who was very passionate about race in America. We were talking about, he's a UFC fighter, current fighter, former champion. I think he gave me yesterday the longest answer anyone has ever given me. I think, no joke, it was like 27 minutes long. I didn't say a word. I just let him go. You got to let the people speak, and you ask your question, you get out of the way. So you did all of that very well. The questions were great, well-researched. Honestly, you're in the big leagues already. It's all about right here. You can hang with all of them. You just have to keep doing it. Like I said, more reps.
Boom. Question for you. When you're interviewing these fighters, how do you know when to not cross the line? You know, you want to ask the tough questions, right? You want to be different and not be afraid to back down. How do you like not worry about insulting or offending?
I mean, as long as you're professional and your questions are fair, then I don't think there's anything to worry about. Like yesterday, I interviewed another fighter named Corey Sanhagen. He's fighting on Saturday. And I asked him, when he wins on Saturday, is he going to ask for a title shot? Because that's what a lot of people do. And he's like, you know, to be honest, I'm not. I'm going to give a shout out to my friend who passed away, and this Saturday is his birthday, or would have been his birthday. You know, it's an emotional thing, you know, more important than calling for a title shot. And I really respect it. And I asked him, do you mind if I ask how he died? And he kind of got choked up and he's like, yeah, I mind. And I said, okay. And I respect that. And then a lot of people gave me crap afterwards, like, oh, why do you have to know everything? Why do you have to ask? And I asked him afterwards, and I don't usually do this. I was like, hey, did you mind that I asked you how he died? He's like, no, not at all. I just didn't really want to talk about it right then. And so to me, the key has always been like, if I was talking to you at a dinner party or at at a party at the street, wherever we may be at school, and you told me like, hey, you know, Saturday's the anniversary of my friend's death, or his birthday would have been on this day. A natural follow-up would be like, oh, what happened to him? You know, especially we're young guys, like, you know, you don't hear that often. And he's younger than me. And you can respond whichever way you want. And I've always viewed interviewing the same way. And that's why I don't write any questions down, because I think it's very important to listen. If you come with a sheet of questions, you're not listening. You're not preparing for follow-ups, because you have to listen to every single word. Someone can give you a 20-minute answer, and then the last three words will be the most important things. And you missed it because you had already the next question in the chamber ready to go. And so that's why, like, if I go to a party tonight, I'm not coming with a sheet of questions. I don't know who I'm going to meet. I'm going to have a conversation. I'm going to listen. I'm going to ask follow-ups, et cetera. And that's always the way I've approached interviewing. Listen, come with an open mind. You could be researched, of course, know the subject, but don't come with preconceived notions or pre-planned questions, because then you're not listening. So, and also just ask like respectful questions, ask questions that you would ask someone in your everyday life. And as long as you're respectful and professional, everything will be okay.
Love it, Ariel. Thank you so much for your time. You know, I think back to high school, your 33 always bothered me. So it's kind of hard to root for you, just with those flashbacks in mind. But honestly, no joke, all the success you have is well-deserved. You worked hard for it, and you deserve even more that's coming your way. So I appreciate you doing this, and it's always good to catch up with you.
Oh, no, I appreciate it very much. And it's great when you reached out to me. I was really excited about it, and I appreciate you even caring to talk to me. And by the way, I glossed over this, but, you know, when I was in, can I just briefly say, you know, obviously your sister dated my cousin for many years, Albert and Michelle.
Maybe that's how I became a Cowboys fan, by the way.
I know. Of course I knew that. I was going to call you out on that. And that's how my brother became a Cowboys fan as well. I thought for a long time, you know, we were very young, but I thought that we would have been, you know, family at one point. But I'm happy that everyone's doing well now. But the one part that I glossed over, and it's a whole other subject for a different day. When I was at Syracuse, I was horribly depressed. It was the darkest 3 years of my life. I missed my family. I missed my friends. I was just very homesick. You know, I was worried that it wasn't the right decision and everyone was the same and all that stuff. And I used to drive the first year down to Syracuse from Montreal with your other sister, Karen, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if she knew how depressed I was. I think she had an idea, and I don't think she was super happy at Syracuse as well, if my memory serves me correct. But it was amazing how, like, I really only knew your middle sister, Michelle, but then ended up meeting Karen and going on those drives with another guy whose name escapes me right now. And like, I actually took comfort in those drives because knowing that there were two other Montrealers there made me feel like, okay, I'm not the only one, even though I don't know these people very well. I knew your family a little bit more than the other guy who drove us. And it's bothered me that I don't remember his name, but it just, I don't know, it gave me comfort. So I wanted to mention, like, with the Syracuse stuff, it was nice to have a Portnoy in my life, and I appreciate them driving me down when I was in the back sobbing.
Awesome. I'll reach out more often. We'll keep in contact more often. Give my best to Jacqueline. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for paying attention and tuning into that episode. If you enjoyed it, please do me a favor. Go leave a 5-star review, leave a review, leave some comments, share it with some friends, spread the love. It would mean the world to me. Thank you so much for your attention and for tuning in. And I will see you on the next episode.